The book of Job is a difficult story about a righteous man who endures incredible suffering. Job, a man who lives a life by wisely fearing God, only to be rewarded with what appears to be God's judgment. How come Job suffers in such a horrible way? How did Job's counseling friends misapply wisdom? When Job finally has a chance to meet with God, it seems that God just beats Job down. Why does the Lord do this? What can possibly be the point of this book? What can this book teach us about wisdom?
Well, in the structure and the flow of Job, this is where you have a speech from Job, you have the counselors speak, and then Job responds, or he retorts. And so this is Job's response to Eliphaz, who has brought a charge against Job and accusations against him. And the summary of what Job has heard, just to refresh your memory, is basically Eliphaz saying to Job, "You've sinned. You've done something wrong. You're not being honest with us. Confess your sin, and the Lord will remove this calamity or this struggle or this plague from you." So now there's this issue. We know the backstory. We know what's going on in this narrative. Job and the counselors do not. They're trying to figure out and piece together who God is and what does it mean to follow this God, and what does it mean to submit to his providence. And there's some pretty harsh lessons in the book of Job, there's no doubt. But the issue before us is basically Job already questioning the wisdom of God and creating this world and whether that was a wise decision. And Job then going on to question God as to why God created Job. What purpose could this man possibly have? And so is this man Job, who is being tested by God, as Job rightly does diagnose, is also being tested by Satan, as both of them are wondering, or Satan's putting the wager on whether or not God can really uphold this servant in the midst of what would be, from his perspective, an unjust trial. Will Job back down on his view of God, or is he going to put forth other ideas of God as he opens his mouth? And so basically, when we look at this speech, I divide it up into three different sections. People divide it up into four, some go into five, but I think three is what we can see just in terms, at least for preaching it. But I think it's Job first saying, please let this end. Secondly, please stop counseling. And thirdly, please cut me free. And the third one is probably the most scary thing at all that Job has said. So this statement then, please let this end, in 6, basically verses 1 through 13. Then here is Job is speaking. He's desiring that the Lord would give him something. He's desiring them to really understand what he is experiencing. And he's using language that echoes Eliphaz's speech. In 5 verses 2 through 7, Eliphaz goes through the word vexation or trouble or turmoil or anger, whatever you want to say. But it's basically a frustration that one can have that may be expressed in anger. And so Job is now taking this word that Eliphaz has stated in 5 verses 2 through 7 and talked about the consequences. Remember, he said basically the fool is the one who gives in to vexation. It kills the fool. And as a result of that, he goes on to talk about the consequences of this death and giving in to vexation. That's a fool's fundamental problem. So Job is now responding, picking up on this from 6 verse, or in 6 verse 2, basically citing Eliphaz in 5 verse 2 and saying, I want you to know there is vexation. Yes, it is true, vexation kills the fool. But oh, that you would understand the weight of my vexation, the weight of my frustration. He uses a language that is heavier than the sands of the sea. Now, the intention of the sands of the sea is to basically be a great weight or a great number that we can't actually say an actual number. This is a promise that the Lord made to Abraham after the sacrifice of Isaac, that the Lord would bless him with descendants like the sand of the sea. You have in Joshua 11, verse 4, with the nations coming out like the sands of the sea. In other words, it's a great number. It's an overwhelming weight. And Job is saying to the counselors, you have no idea what kind of weight I feel right now. Because if you could weigh it, if you could weigh what I'm experiencing in this very moment, it would be greater than an insurmountable sum, an amount we could not even consider or understand or comprehend. That's how weighed down I am. So Job is saying, yes, there is great vexation or frustration in my life right now. But when Eliphaz talked about this vexation and this folly, there becomes something that he goes on to that's implying that basically Job has given in to a great sin and he's frustrated by this sin. And as a result of this, Job is the one who has brought this calamity, this test, this struggle, this hardship, this plague upon himself. Now Job is going on to talk about who's brought this vexation upon him in verse 4 of chapter 6. It's not that Job has done this, but he presents the arrows of the Almighty with poison tips are coming against him. In other words, it's the Lord fighting a dirty battle against this poor man. And it's not just Almighty. This is Shaddai. This is the God who wins every battle. Whenever he goes out against any enemy, any foe, he is always victorious. And so Job is now setting the stage of what he'll build on later in his speech, but it's setting the stage. Here's this lone man, this lone individual. He's not much of a threat to the Lord, but yet look at the overwhelming force that the Lord is bringing against him with these poison darts and these poison arrows and the terrors of God coming against him. There's nothing he can do. And I was crying out as much like the psalmist in Psalm 88, 13. And like the psalmist, as the Lord continues to advance against him and test him and try him, it does not seem as if there's any hope, as if there's any peace. Now as the men go on, Job talks about the absurdity of life, because Eliphaz in his speech is basically saying with Job's vexation, his frustration, he's basically very unwise and maybe too stupid to understand the cause of this problem. And Job lays out this brilliant analogy. And he says, okay, when a donkey receives its food, is the donkey braying? Is the donkey complaining and crying out? No, because the donkey's received what it wants, what it needs to get through that day. When an ox receives its food, its fodder, does it low? Does it complain? Does it call out for something? No, it's quiet, it's content. Job then goes on to talk about his appetite. So he's building on this metaphor of the animals. And it's not so much about the animals, but it's Job saying the animal knows what it needs. When the animal receives what it needs, it's not complaining. It's not frustrated. Job's saying, I'm frustrated. And I'm frustrated because I'm receiving what I don't need. And so it's not that I'm stupid. It's not that I'm a fool. It's not that I've given in to vexation. It's that I've been receiving something I do not need, I do not hunger for, I do not desire. And yet this is my lot. This is what's fed to me. This is what I need to eat, and I have no appetite for it. It's tasteless. It's undesirable. And so Job is then basically saying to these counselors, look, you guys do not understand my desire. I know what I need. I know what I want, and this is not what I want right now. He goes on then to talk about his request. And is also basically a response from Eliphaz's speech in 4 verses 2 through 6. Because Eliphaz talks about death and talks about the issue of Job's integrity and his fear of the Lord and all these things that need to transpire. And so what does Job want? Well, Eliphaz has said in 5 verse 1, call out. Is there anyone who will listen? Anyone who will hear? Job is saying, okay, well, I have called out. I have made my request. I know what I desire. I know what my fundamental want is. And his request is what? God would fulfill my hope. And what is his hope? That God would crush him. That God would just kill him. Bring an end to his life. You see, Eliphaz has talked about how there are those that are out there and how the Lord is the one who can crush man like a moth. In 5 verse 4, how the fool's sons are crushed when he cries out. Now Job is echoing this same language in 6 verse 9. He's saying, I want to be crushed like the fool. I'm not conceding the reality I'm a fool. I'm just saying, I want that fate. That seems desirable to me as the Almighty has engaged in war against me. Now again, as we take a step back and we know what's going on, these counselors in Job does not. It's not the Almighty making war with Job. It's Satan making war with the Almighty, using Job basically as the exemplar, as the pawn in this war. And so Job really is angry at the wrong being. He's angry at God when he should really be angry at Satan and crying out to God. So I just want to call that to your attention at this point. But he goes on to talk about his struggle and the hardship in 11 through 13. What is the end? What is the problem? Well, when you take 11 through 13 in light of verse 10, what does he say in verse 10? I have never abandoned the words of the Almighty. In other words, I have not denied the words of God. And this is an important point because it is true. It's exactly what the prologue tells us. Job has never denied the words of God. He has never challenged God. He has never challenged the goodness of God. In fact, he makes an offering because he's afraid that his children may have cursed God in their heart. And it's important to remember this confession as these speeches go on, because what was the challenge Satan made? You challenge this man, you take away his blessings, and he will curse you to your face. You see, it's going beyond just merely denying the words of God to actually saying that God is guilty, God is sinful, God is wrong, and he wants nothing to do with the Lord. Job is confessing in verse 10, I want something to do with this God. I've never denied his words. I do not understand why this trial, this calamity has come upon me, and I do not desire it. In reality now, he goes on, basically saying, where is my strength? My conscious strength is gone. In other words, Job has emptied out. He has nothing within himself to continue this fight. So he doesn't know, why am I alive? Why do I continue to go forward? He doesn't know. Well, we know. Because the Lord is still upholding this man. And this man has to come to grips with the reality that it's not his strength that sustains him in this battle. It's Satan challenging whether or not God can sustain this man in the midst of this battle. Job, then, is confessing an important point, or two important points, actually. I've never denied the Lord, and I have no strength within me anymore. He's empty. He's done. And so Job, then, is asking this trial, this test to end, just to end in death. He does not desire it. He does not like this. But what about the men who have been sent to comfort him? This is basically verses 14 through 30 of chapter 6. That he talks about these counselors. In 14 through 21, he's talking about the emptiness of their counsel. Verse 14 of chapter 6 is a very significant verse, because he talks about who these men are. And notice what he says. He who withholds kindness from a friend forsakes the fear of the Almighty. These friends think they're encouraging Job and helping Job. But what are they missing? They're missing who God is. And they are withholding kindness. Now, this kindness is along the lines of the Lord showing his loving kindness, his long-suffering to his people. I don't think that's accidental in the speech. I think basically what Job is indicting them for is they're not laying out any promises of the gospel or calling to his attention who God really is. They're making this all about Job. And the reality is, this book really isn't about Job. It's about whether the Lord can uphold Job. And that's what Satan wants to challenge. Satan is saying, can you really uphold these people to love you no matter what they face? Can you uphold your people in such a way that no matter what they experience under the sun, they will not curse you to your face? What have these counselors withheld? The promises of the loving kindness of God, the promises of the gospel, the promises of the cross-shaped logic. That they are not calling Job's attention to a reality beyond Job in the promises of God. And as a result of that, what have they done? They've forsaken the Almighty. Now, who's the Almighty? Shaddai, the one who's making war with Job and casting his arrows on him. Now, when Job talks about the issue then, he's saying that these counselors need to understand wisdom is bigger than they perceive it to be. And I think that's an important thing to take from the book of Job, that Job is also teaching us that we can make wisdom so simplistic of saying that you do the right thing, you always receive the right thing. You do the wrong thing, you receive the wrong thing. Job is saying, guys, I'm learning that wisdom is bigger than what we thought. I'm learning that there's a whole other dimension and understanding of wisdom in a post-fall world that we're not accounting for, that we're not understanding, that God and His providence is far more complex than what we thought, and man does not always understand what God is doing. So will these men make a concession? Well, we don't know. The story continues. It's intended to continue to see if they actually understand wisdom. But Job gives another brilliant metaphor about what it is like to experience this trial. Then he goes on in verses 15 through 21, that he talks about who his brothers are. And the picture is, and it's not that far, in the West Coast we can understand this more than on the East Coast in America, but it's the same thing in the ancient Near East. That we can know that when the sun melts the snow and the water comes out of the mountains, our rivers, our streams are flowing like crazy. You see a lot of water. It becomes dangerous to cross them. But as the summer goes on, the rains dry up, the snow dries up, the snow melt is done. Well, now you can have these streams that may have been scary to cross become these little water beds, or maybe just little puddles, or maybe just rocks. And there's nothing there anymore. And Job is now talking about what happens when caravans would go into the wilderness and they would bank on these waterbeds and bank on these wadis and bank on these waters and have the mindset that these are guaranteed. But they go out into the wilderness and the snow melt is done. The rains do not come. There's no water for them. And so they perish in the wilderness. They're looking for life. They're looking for sustenance. But there's nothing there. Job is saying that is what these men are doing. That they're offering him these false hopes. That it sounds like there's water. There sounds like there's nourishment. But there's nothing substantive. There's nothing that's going to last. There's nothing that's going to give any life. They look upon him, they're afraid. They don't know what to do. And so they say things that's really not that helpful. As Job talks about these counselors and who they are, he goes on to talk in verse 22, when he uses this analogy too, you know, along the lines of Jeremiah 15, verse 20, that if you lend money or you give money, that can place a stress on a friendship, that things can go sideways when money is involved. And Job's now saying to him, why are you being so hard on me? Have I asked for money? Did I ask you for a gift? Did I borrow something and not pay it back, and that there's something that made us go sideways in this endeavor? Well, no, not at all. Job is saying no money has exchanged hands. There's no reason for us to experience this pain and this hardship that we're experiencing with one another. And so what is the desire that Job has? He's saying, look, I haven't asked you for redemption. I haven't asked you to buy me out of trouble. You shouldn't be so angry with me. You shouldn't be here bringing judgments against me and basically creating more strife and more struggle within my heart and tempting me to think that I walk up to this wadi where there's going to be water and there's going to be life and it's bone dry and there's nothing there and I end up dying slowly by the side of this riverbed or this old wadi bed. But he wants them to know He is willing to learn. Now, granted, I think there's some sarcasm going on here. But he's telling these counselors, I'm asking you to stop counseling me. It's not helpful. But if you are going to counsel me, then please instruct me. Because clearly, as he says in verse 24, verse 25, where he's saying, obviously, you think I've done something wrong. Teach me. Show me what I've done wrong. Give me the actual sin that I have done wrong. Let me learn it. Instruct me in this. What is it? You're so certain I've done something wrong. Well, present to me what I've done wrong since you know this so objectively. And the reality is, he's saying, look, you can do this, and if you do this, then I will know what needs to be done. But he lays out who these men are. And he's basically saying, this is what you've done with the Lord's wisdom. That they're like men who would cast lots over the fatherless, bargain over a friend. In other words, these are men who would take the orphan, who has no rights in society, no appeal, no avenue of recourse, and they would actually try and buy this orphan as a slave and try and be the highest bidder. They would take the person that's already exploited and continue to exploit them. Now these men, as Job goes on in his speeches to talk about, you know, judging rightly, these men would say, oh, we'd never do that. But Job is saying, in wisdom, this is what you're doing to me. You're not doing what needs to be done. You're not trying to understand my side of things. And Job goes on then to say, am I not a wise man? Am I really so stupid as I wouldn't understand that this calamity is coming upon me because I've done something? You don't think at this point I would actually turn and repent and put off whatever it's been? Look at me. What have I done? Tell me. You can't tell me? Well, I think I'm wise enough to know what I need to do and what I need to put off. So Job is saying then, please stop. Don't talk anymore. I have enough wisdom. I have enough sense to know what is life, what is wisdom, and what you're giving me is not wisdom. Job goes on then now to turn to the Lord. He's addressed the counselors. Now he goes on in chapter 7, verses 1 through 21, to ask the Lord basically to cut him free, to be done. And I grant this is a very scary request that I never encourage anyone to make, but this is a request that Job makes. He turns and uses this analogy in verses 1 through 7 of who he is. That first he talks about who man is. And he presents God as basically the landowner, as a slave owner. And Job is like that slave, like that hireling working for the rich landowner. Now, of course, the Lord owns the earth. The Lord created the world. So we can understand how Job is taking this and twisting it and perverting it. And he's saying, here I am as a slave, and I really have no rights. I long for the shadow. The shadow never comes. You know, basically relief from the sun, a break from work. I'm like the hireling that longs for my wages because that's my only hope. And when he's like the slave, you know, at least the hireling or the slave can have some nights of relief. And you would think that you go home, you lie in your bed, you lay down, you go to sleep, and you get ready for the next day. And there's some relief. There's a break from the tediousness of what he's going through in life. But Job says, even when I lie down, what happens? The night's long, it drags out. There's no rest. There's no peace. There's no enjoyment. Now he describes the trial of what he's going through. And remember, it's Satan, or the adversary, the one who challenges God and his goodness, who is the one who requested to afflict Job's skin. And the picture that Job has of his skin is not a nice picture. I mean, the ESV cleans it up where it says the worm. It's actually the maggot. It's the presentation that Job has these sores, and it's probably some sort of like a gangrene type thing going on that they scab over. The worm crawls out, or the maggots crawl out, and then we have it break open again. It doesn't sound very nice at all. And Job's saying, this is my life. This is what I'm going through. I say, maybe tonight I can get some relief. And what happens? He experiences the pain of these sores being broken open and feeling the maggots on his skin. This is horrible. And he's saying, why do I live? You can understand a little bit of the man's frustration when he starts putting it this way. There is no relief. Now he talks about how temporary his life is. Basically, the weaver's loom in verse 6 of chapter 7. And the point of this analogy is basically you have the yarn or the thread that goes into the weaver's loom, and it gets joined to the cloth, so you don't really know which thread or which piece of yarn is used. It just joins the cloth. The cloth is cut off. So you can understand how this piece of thread, this yarn, becomes something rather insignificant. It's just like any other piece of thread, any other piece of yarn weaved into this cloth, and the cloth is just used for whatever needs to be done. Job is like that piece of yarn of nothingness that's just weaved into this cloth and goes away. Job himself, he talks about his life being like the wind. And he's asking the Lord now, it seems, for mercy. This too seems to echo along the lines of Psalm 78, of where you have the one who has sinned in Israel, and the Lord has dealt with the sin of Israel as a national people. And how there's a celebration that the Lord knows that that man is basically just like the wind. He's just of dust. He's really nothing in comparison to who God is. God remembers he made them. They were just flesh. They were wind. And they're really nothing that lasts. And the Lord is then merciful. Job is basically calling out for the Lord, please, just have mercy on me. Finish me off. Let it be done. I'm nothing in your sight. I'm nothing that's going to endure. So just let this be done. But now he talks about a rather traumatic thing. And something that is untrue. That in 7 verse 9, he goes on to talk about what death is. That you die, you go to Sheol, you go to the realm of the dead, you never rise up. Now when Job is saying this, he's forgetting that there is a resurrection. He's forgetting 2 Kings 4:21, where you have Elijah raising the widow's son. Now that son really isn't that significant in and of himself because he's a son of a widow. The son is more significant for the widow than for the son to have life. But you're seeing again this reminder when Job says when they go down to Sheol, they don't rise again. Well, the Lord cares for a widow outside of Israel through Elijah to raise up her son so she can have life and security. So this is not true. This is not consistent. But Job then goes on to make this case of who God is. Again, sort of picking up the theme of Shaddai with the arrows in verses 11 through 21 and just quickly running through these verses. As 1 through 5, he stated he's trapped by life. There's not a whole lot he can do. But the Lord pursues Job then like this sea monster. Again, this is probably along the lines of like Leviathan, the sea monster that dwells in Sheol in the heart of the sea. Sea monster is a great thing that God has to keep in control. And Job's saying, who am I? A mere man that you keep me in check like this sea monster. What do you do to me? You terrify me with visions. You make it so it's difficult for me to sleep. And he goes on to just talk about the misery of what's going on, of how the Lord is there visiting him and how the Lord is not visiting him in a positive way and watches him in such minute detail that the Lord knows every time Job swallows his spit. He's saying to the Lord, I'm merely a piece of yarn that's weaved into the weaver's cloth. I'm insignificant. Why do you pursue me in this way? But then he goes on, and I'd argue he's really starting to cross the line. Because as he talks about loathing his life, and he's talking about this struggle, in verse 17, it's almost a verbatim citation of Psalm 8. The Psalm 8 is a praise of God for taking man, putting him above the animals, and making man just a little less than God, that God's not threatened by man, but actually elevates man in his place. In other words, what is man? You are so mindful of him. It's a praise to God. Here Job is saying, what is man? You're so mindful of him. It's intended to be sarcastic. Why are you so threatened by me that you need to keep me in such check and pursue me and beat me down in such a way and continually look at who I am? But what does he want? He wants the Lord to just leave him alone. He wants the Lord to just let him be. But if we skip down to verse 21, this is where you have that hope. Because he asks now an important question. Why do you not just pardon my transgression? In other words, if this is a sin I've done and I am too stupid to see it and I'm too ignorant and I'm too blind to look within myself and see what's causing it, just take it away. That's who you are as a loving God. But he says, here's the problem, Lord. I'm going to continue to go down this course. I'm going to continue to experience this pain. You're going to look out in the earth and look for me, and I'm no longer going to be there. I'm just simply going to be taken away. And so Job then is asking the Lord to make it so he goes away. But what is Job then really doing? We ask the question in conclusion. Is Job really going to backtrack on his claims of God? And the reality is Job's not fully going back on questioning the wisdom of God. Now, he has not cursed God to his face, as Satan said he would. But he's walking a dangerous line. And he's getting very close to cursing God. And this is not a good thing. But Job also sees that as God does this, there is that hope in verse 21 of knowing that God is the Redeemer. He can take away these transgressions and offenses and iniquity. And Job will cling to this as he goes on in his speeches. And at the end of the book, this will be his final hope. But what do we do with this speech? I think once again, going through this speech, it is a little overwhelming. Our Lord is rather thick-skinned. I don't know why God puts up with this. But yet the Lord allows these series of speeches to continue for quite a while before he intervenes and he gives Job his day in court as Job requests. And I think what we understand from the Lord is he is long-suffering. And he is a God who is calling us to call out to him and to express our frustrations as we experience them. But at the same time, I don't think the counselors and I don't think Job is excused, because he does call them to account in 6:14. If you deny the wisdom of the Almighty, you are denying the fear of the Lord. And I think that's where we need to go in the midst of our frustration, in the midst of our crying out to God. While we may not understand what the Lord is doing, we may perceive an injustice in what we experience, the reality is we're living in a post-fall world. And I think we need to also understand, how often do we thank God when everything goes right? How often do we say to the Lord, praise you that everything fell into place and I managed to drive and do my errands and didn't fall into a nasty, horrible accident? Thank you for your providential care. The reality is, as humans, we expect the Lord to do that for us. And praise God that he does, despite our gratitude to him. But the reality at the back of this speech, and the reality of who God is I think it is this reminder that what Job is requesting, God is too gracious to give to Job. Because there is one who receives this request, who, as Job is saying, leave me alone, let me die, let me just go to the realm of Sheol, let me go to the realm of death and remove your care and your leash from me. The Lord's not going to do that to Job, because he's too gracious, because God knows what that means. And we know that because there is one who has had this leash and this care removed from him, where it is Christ on the cross. And what does he do? Christ, the second person of the Trinity, the God-man, who knows God in a way we never will, because he is God, cries out with what? My God, why have you forsaken me? When he really experiences the pain of hell and what that is, he cries out in utter anguish. The very request that Job makes here, the ultimate champion endures. Let us then understand who God is. A God who is too gracious and long-suffering to give us what we deserve. A God who is gracious and long-suffering, who invites us to call out to Him, no matter what we may think, no matter what we may feel, to call out to Him, to express our frustrations of this life under the sun, but to also wrestle with who God is in a good way, and to wrestle with the promises of His canon, because there are remnants in here, 6 verse 14, that fear the Lord, knowing who God is and His long-suffering nature. That the book of Job, then, is a book that really speaks to all of us, no matter where we are in our Christian life. It cautions us when we feel self-righteous, to think we're worthy of the blessings we receive. We're not. God is gracious and freely bestows them upon us. When we're in the midst of trial, in the midst of turmoil, in the midst of depression, and feel as if things are not going as we want them to go, the Lord's saying, call out to me. I'm here. But it's to also understand that the turmoil and the pain that we experience is not because of God. Let us not attribute the pervertedness of Satan to the good God that we serve. This is what the counselors in Job are wrestling with in this book, and this is probably the most overwhelming thing, that God allows all these cycles and this long, drawn-out wrestling before He intervenes and calls Job to account. Let us not get to that stage, but let us understand who our God is. As Job goes on to say, I know my Redeemer lives. As he says here in 7 verse 21, why do you not pardon my transgression? Let us understand our God has pardoned our transgression, and He has secured us in the way of heaven. Let us then walk in His wisdom, even when we cannot understand how the cross-shaped logic of the living God is being worked out. But let us walk in His wisdom, believing that what He has ordered and set out for us is something that is valuable, something that is good, something that brings glory to His name, and far less than we ultimately deserve, because we are not on the cross crying out, my God, why have you forsaken me? But we are those who have triumphed over death in Christ as we take hold of Him by faith. Let that forever be our hope, that our God does pardon our transgressions. Amen.
Thank you for listening to our broadcast. We hope and pray that you were edified through the preaching of the gospel. If you have any questions about our church, please contact our pastor through our webpage, urcbelgrade. That is urcbelgrade.com. We hope to hear from you, and most of all, we hope to see you sojourning and fellowshipping with us each Sunday. Until we meet again, may the Lord's blessing and peace be upon you.